on that Thursday night to Friday time period. For the rest of this afternoon, though, mostly cloudy and a high of 28 degrees. The winds out of the northwest at 10 to 15 miles an hour. Cloudy again tonight, the low of 18. Winds from the north at 5 to 10. Then winds die down a little bit more, but still are out of the north for tomorrow. Mostly cloudy day again and high of 27 degrees for Thursday. Tomorrow night, cloudy, a chance of snow developing after midnight, a low of 22. And on Friday, cloudy with a chance of snow. The Christmas Eve day, high 30 degrees. Cloudy Friday night with a chance of evening snow and then some scattered flurries after midnight. Good atmospheric snow, I guess, as we head into Christmas Day, the low of around 23. And on Christmas Day itself, mostly cloudy with scattered flurries at a high of 25. The extended forecast calls for a mostly cloudy Christmas night through Tuesday. Highs throughout that period in the low 20s, lows 13 on Christmas night, and then the upper single digits on Sunday and Monday nights. As mentioned, just under the freezing mark in most of East Central Illinois. Looking around the part of the state, it's 30 degrees in Pontiac and Peoria and Springfield and in Rantoul at this hour. Decatur has a cloudy sky and 28 degrees, as does Danville. Mattoon, cloudy and 29, cloudy and 25 in Paris. And in Peoria, as I mentioned, 30 degrees. At Willard Airport, at the top of the hour, it was 28 degrees. Our winds were out of the northwest at 16 miles an hour. That creates a wind chill of 16 degrees. Dew point at 24, the relative humidity at 85%. And the barometer is steady at 30.25 inches. Looking elsewhere in the state, at O'Hare, light snow and 33 at the top of the hour. Rockford, some light snow and 33 as well. Partly sunny and 34 in Kankakee. And in Quincy, cloudy and 28. Down south, we've got cloudy and 30 in Carbondale. Alton, cloudy and 32. Right now on Friends Plaza on the University of Illinois campus, it's cloudy and 28 degrees. It's 12:39. There's a core group of reporters and anchors that people think about when they hear the phrase All Things Considered on NPR, and one of the hosts over the years was Noah Adams. His low-key baritone voice took us around the nation and around the world. Adams has collaborated with several other NPR reporters to compile a book of the network's first 40 years. And he says even though public radio is strong now, it began back in the late 60s and early 70s as an afterthought.
The original legislation in 1967 was public television, the Public Television Act. And a lot of people in college radio stations around the country sort of in an underground way, very sneaky, working very quietly, tried to figure out a way to get radio to be a part of the public broadcasting bank account. Yeah. And they worked, and they found a draft of the bill and the people who were putting it together. And over one weekend in Washington, D.C., I'll never forget this, this is great, they typed out the words and radio, kept typing that. And then they cut out the little pieces of paper, and they got the draft, and they put it in there. So every time it would say,
well, before, long before the word processing era.
For sure, every time it would say television, they would put in, they would paste in and radio. So eventually, that week, it went to the White House, it went to Capitol Hill, and radio got to be part of the, what was then called the Public Broadcasting Act, not public television. Radio got 10% of the money. Now, that doesn't seem like much, but it turned out to be enough, because look what has happened over the years with that 10%.
All right. The network got off the ground with All Things Considered, and the first day that All Things Considered came on the air, there was a massive protest on the Vietnam War. And through those early years, NPR had made a name for itself covering things like that, covering the Watergate hearings. How did the early events shape National Public Radio? Because those are pretty tumultuous times in the early 70s.
Yeah, it was just an amazing piece of luck in a way. You couldn't plan it. The date has long been set, May 3rd, 1971, and it turned out to be a day of tremendous demonstration unrest there in the nation's capital. And so NPR had a pretty important program that day, and they were ready to cover it. Now, there, I must say that if you plan a program months ahead, you put a lot of things up on the planning board. And one of the stories they put up that day was a story about a barber in Iowa who was trying to make extra money by shaving women's legs. And the story was that he refused to shave men's legs. And so that was the whole story. It was about 6 minutes long. Well, they had that story, you know, on the shelf, and they ran it. So here's this big day of demonstrations in the nation's capital, and they cover that fine, and then here comes the story about the barber in Iowa who shaves women's legs, and it got on the air anyway. So that's the kind of thing that can happen. But as you say...
But that happened over and over. That's how All Things Considered seemed to have gotten its name, for covering offbeat things that you wouldn't have heard elsewhere.
Yeah, but that was just... I think that was just a mistake.
You're
right.
Expecting a slow day, and...
Right. All Things Considered, and that's true. I mean, rarely has there been a day that something hasn't come along that's been... that will just take you out of the mindset of drama on the world stage into something that you know, in the long run may be more important, in the short run at least is listenable and will make you smile just a little bit.
And you came to NPR 4 years after the start as a production assistant, correct?
Right. I came from a station in Kentucky. I came from WBKY at the University of Kentucky. I had volunteered for that station and to do music and bluegrass music and progressive rock, and I did a documentary. And I did some news, and I decided I wanted to try to work in Washington, and I went there, put everything in the car, and went there.
You talk in the book about some of the people who helped bring NPR into existence and had the organization. Bill Siemering was the first leader, I guess, of NPR. How did he and the other people who came in those early eras envision the public radio system and then help it develop?
Well, it's very interesting. And I'm glad I got a chance to write the 70s chapter of this book, because it took me into a turning point in NPR's development, and it happens at the end of the 70s. Bill Siemering, you mentioned, he is a radio visionary, and he'd come from Buffalo, and where he was doing experimental broadcasting in that community there, and he was hired to set up this program, All Things Considered, and he wanted it to be conversational. He wanted it to reflect the sense and the feeling of what it's like to be out in the community, worried about your neighborhood, worried about your town, worried about your state, your country, the nation, the world, the universe. And he wanted, above all, he wanted it to be conversational. And he wanted it to celebrate the human experience. Now, that's quite a bit different than a hard news, straight-ahead outlook. And Bill was fired a short time into his tenure there and went on to do other things in public radio. Bill, by the way, developed a program in Buffalo that became Terry Gross's Fresh Air program in Philadelphia. So he knew what he was doing. And a lot of us are just, for a lot of us in the industry, he's just a hero, still is.
NPR has always sort of been on the edge as far as financial viability as well in those early days, especially. And you talk about how the management change with Frank Mankiewicz coming in. How did that affect NPR, and where did it take the organization?
The Mankiewicz hiring speaks to the point I was making about the change in direction. Mm-hmm. Should it be hard news, or should it be a softer program that does celebrate the human experience? And Mankiewicz came in, terrible financial manager. He had the biggest – I remember him walking in, Frank Mankiewicz we're talking about, coming in the first day, and he had this huge Rolodex. Nobody carries around a Rolodex anymore, but he walked in, and I said, that's why we hired him. He knew everybody on the West Coast in Hollywood, on the East Coast in politics. He'd been Robert Kennedy's press secretary, long involved in politics. And he thought that it should be a straight-ahead news operation. He wanted to compete with everybody else. And we said, no, I don't think so. And so that his way, actually, and he was asked to leave eventually, his way prevailed. And thank goodness it did. Because at the same time, all the commercial news networks were sort of giving up.
On radio.
Right. On radio. And why is that the case? Why is WBUR in Boston, for example, number one in the Boston news market? It's a great station. They do a great job. But for the most part, commercial radio gave up. And so that's what happened. So Mankiewicz was right. Siemering was right, and what you have on these programs is a combination of both points of view, and they're equally important. And now I'm very proud of the fact that, for example, in overseas reporting and foreign affairs, NPR has 16 bureaus at a time around the world, at a time when everybody else is pulling his people back.
So where does NPR stand now with that stature and with, you know, the uncertainty that faces public broadcasting?
Well, I don't think there is any uncertainty at all. There's a little bit of concern about funding right now. I think that will blow over. There hasn't been a major challenge to funding for 10 years. And when it happened last, the support that arose from the communities and was passed along to the members of Congress was very, very strong, and that's going to be even more strong this year. But I think that NPR is actually poised to achieve a leadership role in news gathering, and certainly with the support of the local stations. I'll give you an example. Vivian Schiller is the CEO of National Public Radio, as you know, and she has said, what does NPR have? What does NPR have that the New York Times does not have? And the answer is WILL. The answer is 600 local stations doing great work around the country. New York Times does not have that, doesn't have 600 bureaus. And that's the real answer. And I take it a step farther. I can say, and maybe NPR would be upset with me for saying this, but I can say this, that NPR could go away. And the stations are so strong around the country, they could figure out how to get national and overseas news. Not as good, but they could do it, and they would still be there serving the community. And when all else fails, that's going to be the important thing.
What about the uncertainty of radio, maybe even as a medium, with the fact that we may be relying more on the Internet for information?
Figure this. 20 years from now, you're driving along, and you're thinking of All Things Considered, and it comes into your brain, just thinking of it. It comes into your brain, and you hear Melissa Block talking about Richard Holbrook, who just died, or talking about some other news story, and you realize you're getting it through your brain. Radio telepathy. Well, that sounds absurd, but 20 years from now, you might remember that Noah said this on my radio show, because things like that could happen. I don't mean to be absurd about it. I don't mean to be too fanciful about it, but technology is going to keep apace and way out in front of us. So a radio transmitter is just a device, and there will be other devices. I just read that the people who make Kindle, the electronic reader, Amazon people who make Kindle, they know what page you're on when you're reading the book that you paid to download.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They know when you stop reading it. They know that you haven't picked it up for 2 weeks. So 20 years from now, you'll be able to figure out in your own brain how to get the radio station signal into your head.
Noah Adams is practicing his skill as a visionary, as a contributing correspondent for NPR. The former All Things Considered co-host wrote about the network's early days for the book entitled This is NPR, The First 40 Years.